Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to The Andy Pin Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool.
We are back on The Andy Pin Show, and the Finn Man's here with Robin and with Steve Farnsworth, a professor in the Department of Communication at George Mason. And Steve, is you are a student and an expert on presidential politics and how the presidents deal with the media. So we're talking about temperament before we left, and that Obama seems to be a man of on an even keel, as my dad used to say, as opposed to some of the mercurial or flawed maybe characters we've had in recent years.
During the campaign of 2008, Obama pretty consistently ran a flawless campaign.
That's right.
It's really striking how, despite all the experience that the Clinton team had in running for office, that the truly experienced campaigner looked to be Barack Obama. He really only, I would say, made one serious mistake. Two. One was getting on the bowling alley floor in Pennsylvania
and, that was
and bowling a 37.
That was okay. A minor mistake.
But fundamentally,
hey, that was only 8 frames, buddy.
Okay, so we'll spot him 30 or 40 points. It still doesn't bring him up into triple digits.
No, it does not.
And so, that gutter ball looked bad.
And so, but ultimately, people in America are used to looking at these politicians on the basis of how they perform at ordinary things. You ask the question,
right.
Who would you rather have at a backyard barbecue, George Bush or Al Gore? And it's pretty clear. George Bush, he would take a turn at the grill, he'd watch the kids, he'd be a fine person to have as a neighbor looking at your backyard barbecue, making sure that the burgers don't burn. Al Gore, I could imagine, you know, asking where the veggie burgers are, talking about how the charcoal is related to global warming in some way. You know, fundamentally, I don't know that he'd make the friendliest neighbor. Now, I think Al Gore probably would have made a better president than George Bush did, but he wasn't being evaluated on the basis of presidentialness.
Which is weird, but...
Right. But and so this is one of the real risks that you have. And so I think that ultimately Obama, although he made a couple of mistakes in terms of his, you know, demonstrating the extent to which he doesn't necessarily connect with working class whites, ultimately, you know, it didn't matter that much because the economy went into such a tailspin in September and October that there was very little that McCain could do to win this election. I think
right.
that fundamentally, if you look at the situation on, say, Labor Day, at the end of the Republican convention, it was clear that this was a fight to the finish. But then the stock market tanked. Then the number of people losing their jobs crept up throughout September and October. And John McCain looked like the reckless one. He talks about canceling a debate. He talks about rescheduling a debate. He talks about a bailout. He likes it. He doesn't like it. Who knows what he thinks.
Right.
He becomes – he spins in 360 degrees over the course of just even a few hours. And so the McCain campaign really looked rattled.
Yes, it did.
And it was Obama who was new to this. I mean, remember, just 4 years ago, he was in the Illinois State Senate. He's the one who looked like he really understood it.
That's right.
He had a very effective team. But fundamentally, what I think – people like about Obama, and what will be interesting to watch in an Obama presidency, is the extent to which he can handle things without getting, without there being a drama. They call it no drama Obama.
Yeah. That's right.
I think that that's exactly what people want to see in a president. They don't want to see somebody who is a bad soap opera. That they want to see somebody who is up to the job and who doesn't get rattled easily. And certainly with all the problems facing this country right now, a president who gets rattled easily would be a bad situation.
That's the truth. But what I said at the time was that the difference is that McCain's background is he's a fighter pilot, so he's a risk taker. And he shoots from the hip, and he's out there putting it on the line every day kind of a guy. And Obama is a lawyer and a law professor. And so he's deliberate, and he sits back and evaluates, and that's what I want in the White House.
Well, I think it had to do a lot with the circumstances of 2008. If this election had taken place in 2004, I think McCain probably would have won. If this had been a national security election, that people would have felt a lot more comfortable about McCain. If you look back at those debates, the one time that I think that McCain was really the most sure-footed was when he was talking about foreign policy.
Right.
Unfortunately for McCain, there wasn't all that much of a conversation about foreign policy in this election. This was a domestic policy election focused on the economy, which exactly did not play to McCain's strong suit.
Well, do you agree, though, that even if, let's imagine the economy had not tanked, it headed the way it was looking to head before September 15th, so it looked like, you know, we were maybe headed for a recession, but we weren't in panic mode. Do you agree that Obama would have won, or do you not think he would have won?
I think that it's an open question whether Obama would have won if the economic situation hadn't really worsened in September. I mean, the polls showed that McCain was ahead. I think McCain, you know, he made one mistake, one big mistake, named Sarah Palin. I think that fundamentally the best argument that McCain had against Obama was that Obama wasn't all that experienced.
That's right.
And when you take somebody, mayor of Wasilla, Alaska, right, until very recently, and then suddenly a governor, and you say that this person is ready for prime time, why, it really undermines your ability to make the most effective argument you can make against Obama. I think McCain had to stop talking about experience as soon as he put Palin on the ticket.
Right,
but that was why she was so dangerous for the McCain
campaign.
Fatal
cancer. I mean, that was just getting bigger.
I guess it was, yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. It strikes me that McCain made a conscious decision before they chose Palin to move away from the experience argument. And I have to believe that what they decided was, look, Hillary tried to beat Obama with the experience argument, and it didn't work. And we're going to end up losing by 3 points if we see this to the end, yelling experience versus change. This is a change election. We need to be the change campaign, and you, John McCain, you're the change candidate. So he said, okay, how can I be the change candidate? I'm a maverick, so I can distance myself from Bush and be the maverick, and then I need a partner who's a maverick. And I think that's where they came up with Palin, that it isn't like they chose Palin and then he decided, oh, now we have to give up the experience argument. I think they decided experience was a loser.
Well, I think that for Hillary Clinton, it was a loser because Hillary Clinton wasn't all that experienced. Remember, she had only been in the Senate for 8 years. John McCain has been in Washington for 20 years. Nobody's resume tops John McCain's resume. That kind of experience was superior to Bush's in 2000. It was superior to Clinton's in 92 when Clinton ran for president the first time. It was really an extraordinary collection of experiences of public service that prepared him for being president. Seems to me that the experience argument was the best thing that John McCain had going for him. I tend to think that McCain would have been much better off if he'd gone down the road of picking, say, a Tom Ridge for the former governor of Pennsylvania, the head of Homeland Security, try to double down on the foreign policy questions.
And assume the base would stay with him even though Ridge was pro-choice.
Probably the smartest move of all for him might very well have been Joe Lieberman, because if you really want a maverick, who's more of a maverick than Joe Lieberman? He's not even a member of any party at the moment.
Well, the base would have gone nuts, though, because he's not only pro-choice, he's a liberal on so many issues.
Well, where is the base going to go? You know,
they're going to stay home, is the argument.
Well, but you know, the Republican Party is not about people who are staying home. I mean, if you see poll after poll after poll. Now, the Democrats, if they don't like the nominee, they're much more likely to stay home. But the Republicans, they come in the rain, they come in the snow, they vote for the Republican Party. Now, they may not give a lot of money, that's true. But fundamentally, you know, I think the Republican Party worries too much about the base, and that's why they keep losing elections. Because the more you satisfy the base, the more you offend those centrist voters. And this is going to be a bigger and bigger problem for the Republican Party going forward, because as today's younger people become a significantly larger part of the electorate, they are just not going to be making their votes count on the questions of abortion. They care about a lot of other things besides gay marriage and abortion. And so the old issues that work for the Republicans in the years going forward are just not going to be that effective. So the Republican Party needs to retool, seems to me. And it doesn't retool in the direction of Sarah Palin. It retools in the direction of winning the moderate voters. Because without the moderate voters, you don't win the election.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that the choice of Palin meant that McCain was doubling down on the base. And Rove showed that you can win an election by running to the base in 2000 and 2004. But most experts agreed by 2008 that wasn't the way to go. And frankly, I thought when the Republicans picked McCain, it was their best candidate because he was the only guy that could possibly beat the Democrats this year.
You know, I've always been amazed that so many people take seriously what Karl Rove has to say. You
know, I agree.
You know, it is really striking that a man so consistently wrong, I mean, he's wrong oftentimes, at, you know, comparable to Tom Friedman in his international assessments of the progress that's going on in Iraq.
I think we're talking about the Friedman unit, the 6 months.
6 months,
moving
just
target.
Another 6 months, right. Maybe if the election had occurred 6 months later, Karl Rove would have been right. But anyway, the reality is that Karl Rove is pretty consistently wrong on a lot of these issues. And particularly when you talk about what might have worked in the past, I think that the 2004 election was really a winnable election for the Democrats. I think that John Kerry was a poor nominee and the campaign was poorly executed. I think that what the Democratic Party needed was somebody who had voted against the war in 2004. They needed somebody like Obama in 2004.
Well, Howard Dean.
Well, a sane version, a competent version, an experienced version of Howard Dean. Somebody who had been, you know, a little less inclined to make people think twice about his his performance and his experience. That ultimately, you know, all the Democrats who ran in 2004, with the exception of Dean, had voted for the war.
Right.
And it was really hard for any of them to really back up from that. And Howard Dean and, you know, perhaps others in the Democratic Party who could have run, I mean, who did chose not to because they imagined Bush being relatively strong in 2004, fundamentally, you take the most significant problem of the Bush years and you take it off the table when you put somebody like John Kerry on there. Now, John Kerry could have, of course, you know, channeled his inner Howard Dean, if he has such an inner Howard Dean, and said fundamentally that Bush lied to the country and that Bush created the conditions in which the Senate, having only a limited amount of information, voted for the war because of the distortions in the evidence that Bush put forward. Kerry could have said something like that, but he
didn't. I think he did make that argument.
Well, but what Kerry said and what people remember is that he voted for the $80 billion before he voted against it.
Well,
you know,
right.
But American voters do not want a Hamlet for president. They just don't.
Right.
And Bill, you know, and Bill Clinton understood that, you know. But the problem with John Kerry, I think fundamentally, was that he was too thoughtful for the kind of immediate response that's required on television.
Well,
if you're used to speaking in the Senate and you're used to speaking in paragraphs that go on for pages, you just don't get the 10-second soundbite. You don't get the fact that if you're not clear and you're not direct, you've lost the public.
And I guess this gets us back to this issue of it's the individual versus the party and how candidates win. I asked you before if you thought Obama would have beat McCain. You said, you know, it's debatable. I always believe Obama was going to beat McCain. Now, the meltdown made it roughly a seven-point victory, but I always believed he would win in the same, and I just wonder what you think of this analysis, in the same way that in 1980, when the country saw Ronald Reagan stand in those debates against Carter, in that debate, the one debate, Carter had been trying to paint Reagan as too risky and maybe a wild man. You didn't know what he'd do with that nuclear button. And when they got into the debates, the country sized him up and said, you know, this guy can be president. And I always believed, no matter what happened with Reverend Wright and all the little twists and turns, I reassured my friends who were for Obama that it comes down to those debates, especially the first debate. And when Obama stands up there next to McCain, first of all, he's taller. Secondly, we don't elect bald men president, so I figured it was all over at that point.
Well, I think that Obama did quite well in the debates, but it's important to remember that where Obama was weakest was foreign policy. But that didn't matter to too many people, particularly as September gives way to October, and these economic issues are paramount.
Well, that first debate was supposed to be foreign policy, and it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's because of the economic meltdown.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
did
yeah.
not
that's
have
right.
you, McCain did not have a fair opportunity to discuss as much foreign policy as he wanted.
True.
That was the nature of circumstances during the fall. I think, though, that ultimately if this judgment about Obama— the uncertainty, the risk that he represented. I mean, obviously, every debate, when you have the two people up to, you know, standing side to side, you know, it's rare that they make a sufficiently large error of fact that one of them is disqualified. I mean, we could look at, say, Gerry Ford in 1976.
That's really the
talking
only
about
one.
Poland.
Yep.
You know, it's if you're president, it's a good idea during the middle of the Cold War to know which team Poland is on. This was a big mistake.
He was making a philosophical wish, I suppose.
Well, but, you know, he was offered several opportunities by the reporters
That's
president
true.
To try to correct it and to make it clear what he meant, and he could not handle it.
For those of you who are too young to remember, this is the statement that Poland is not under the domination of the Soviet Union. And, of course, they were.
True enough. And so I think that, you know, that people do look at these people as
and
viable.
And that was in the debate itself?
It was in the debate.
But let's see, John McCain made a lot of mistakes, but not in a debate. He would make, what were some of those mistakes?
Oh, he talked about the border between Iraq and Pakistan, yeah. I think it was, and that Al-Qaeda was going into Iran to be trained. Of course, they wouldn't. They were Sunnis. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he got those screwed up. We don't need to go over all the details here. But so he had met several statements of fact but he didn't make those mistakes in the debates. That's right.
Right. During the debate, I think both candidates looked good.
I agree.
That I think that, you know, that fundamentally they both benefited from the debates. It's just that the issue mix really, really hurt McCain. Had this been a different set of circumstances, I think McCain really could have won. I think that the biggest irony, perhaps, of this election is that John McCain was beaten twice by George Bush. He was beaten by Bush in 2000 in the primary campaign. I think in many ways he was beaten by Bush again in 2008. That's not to take away from Obama's victory, but
fundamentally,
McCain had to face a serious headwind that got more and more difficult for him as the economy worsened in September and October. But if you look at the poll numbers at the end of the debates, you know, the numbers did not really turn decisively in Obama's direction until October.
Well, there's a couple of things about that it strikes me as. One is that we're back to this issue of who do you want to have the beer with or who do you want in your barbecue. It seems to me that Obama won each of the debates, and when they asked people why, if you ask the pundits, the Republican pundits all thought McCain scored his points, just like they thought Democrats thought Gore scored his points or Kerry scored his. But it comes down to this likability factor, and McCain was on the attack and talked down to Obama at times and said, what you have to understand, Senator Obama, is that kind of talk. And Obama didn't dish it back to him. He didn't try and skewer McCain. He showed respect, and he was unflappable. And I thought that what came out of those ratings in those debates was that Obama was he won the debates in part because he was more likable.
Absolutely. I think that the John McCain campaign got really frustrated. In many ways, it sort of felt to me like Bob Dole in 96. You know, when Bob Dole was talking about, you know, where's the outrage? There are all these horrible things going on in the Clinton years, Bob Dole thought. And America wasn't really seeing it. And it just made him madder and madder as the campaign progressed. And I think John McCain ultimately ended up in a very similar position to Bob Dole in 96, that he really felt like he was more experienced. And yet people weren't seeing it. And it was a very frustrating experience for John McCain. And, you know, it's ironic, you know, that somebody who, had he been the Republican nominee in 2000, probably would have won 45 states.
No question. He said at the time, I sent John McCain $100 back in 99, and he said at the time, before Bush beat him in the primary, I will beat Al Gore like a drum. And he really would have beat Gore pretty handily, I think. It would not have been a very close election because he really was the maverick back then. He really was reaching across the aisle. And, of course, the problem is you have to run to your base during the primaries, and he wasn't doing that, and he didn't get the nomination. It's very much what happened to Hillary, really. Hillary thought she could move to the center during the primaries, and she didn't guard their left flank, and she couldn't get the nomination in the end. Now, they made strategic mistakes as well.
Well, I think ultimately Hillary Clinton was defeated by the Iraq War. She voted for the war. She defended it for too long. And the Democratic activists who voted in the caucuses and the primaries never really forgave her for it. I think that ultimately that one vote cost her the White House.
Yeah, and I argue just her caution cost her the White House because she hedged her bets on all of that. But also I think, again, you said not to take too much away from Obama. People like Obama and Clinton, and some would say Bush, but I'll just say Reagan, emerged. They just come out of the woodwork, and suddenly they are just this megastar on the political scene. They have what it takes, and they're just unstoppable.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think that ultimately what America wants above all is newness. We want novelty. We want what we don't have.
Right.
So with Bill Clinton, you had a drama, you had a sordid White House, and George Bush, for whatever flaws we may attribute to him, he fundamentally was not Bill Clinton. You know, he kept it in the road. There was no debauchery to speak of during the Bush years in terms of personal misconduct. Now, perhaps the American public is more interested in a competent president. And so, you know, we're going in the direction of what we don't have. I think that, you know, that this is the natural progression of human nature. What you have is not what you want going forward. And if we look back at Jimmy Carter was honest. Nixon wasn't. You know, it seemed like a nice idea.
Right.
And, you know, Jimmy Carter had his problems in the 70s. It looked like maybe somebody tougher, Reagan, could solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And so the cycle continues. You know, ultimately you sell yourself as what we don't have now. And that what really works with America. We always like the newer, better, flashier version of something. And that goes for our politics as well as our cornflakes.
Yeah. Well, a final comment here. I'm going to suggest that I'm interested in hearing what the religious right thinks about this. We've had two born-again Christian presidents, Jimmy Carter, who Republicans claim is the worst president in their lifetime, and now George Bush, who the rest of the country claims is the worst president in our lifetime. And so I'm wondering if that's just coincidence. And you may not even care to comment about that.
Well, you know, what is the saying? You know, do not visit the sins of the father on the son. So, you know, people are free to make their own decisions. But I think that that the question of religion has less to do with the frustrations that America has with George Bush than actually what he did in office.
Oh, didn't
no,
he?
I think Carter may have gotten in trouble because he acted like a Christian as president. Perhaps. Mm-hmm. You could make that argument.
Yeah.
Human rights.
But Bush, he came in saying he was going to have a foreign policy based on humility. I don't know where that was coming from in the beginning.
Oh, yes.
He hadn't talked to Cheney yet, I think.
Well, he was a compassionate conservative as a candidate, not so much as a president.
That's right. All right. Well, Steve, thanks for being here. You're going to stay around for the last few minutes, but we're going to move on to another kind of a topic. I appreciate you being here. Again, the book is called Spinner in Chief. Steve is an associate professor, I think, aren't
assistant.
You? Assistant. You're an assistant. Oh, that's so unfair. So this man is a genuine scholar. How many books have you written?
Four.
He's got four books out, and we brought him in as an assistant professor. It's like, hey, we're just stealing, you know? So he should be, you'll be an associate before
well,
very long.
Well, you know, all contributions are gratefully accepted.
Exactly. Yes.
I'm
send him to,
for the
send him in my name.
800 number.
Send him in my name to the Department of Communication at George Mason University. But now you'll be associate before long. But so Steve is a professor at the Department of Communication, my department. And as I say, we are lucky to have you.
And thank you. It's been fun.
I'm glad you've been here. Thank you.
Do you feel inferior? Do you sometimes think that you're not as bright as the rest of us? The Andy Finn Show has the cure. Listen to stories about some real idiots. Yes, it's time for another edition of Wackos, Bunkos, and Locos. Tales of the not so bright among us.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and Robin, I think you've got a little bit of Wackos to share with us. Do you not?
Yes, indeed I do.
So what is going on out there in the world?
Well, let's see. From ABC News, get busy living or get busy dying. Two of Oregon's unique public health markers clashed dramatically for resident Barbara Wagner this summer when she was informed that the universal medical care available to everyone in the state, but with certain service restrictions, would not pay for her expensive lung cancer drug because her five-year survival likelihood was poor. She was told at the same time that the state would pay for any necessary drugs under its death with dignity law. Just trying to speed things along.
They won't pay to keep you alive, but they'll pay to help you die quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one way to solve the problem, if that's a problem.
Yeah, it would be for Barbara, I would think.
I am sure it is. I hope she's still with us.
Now let's
Barbara,
see.
If you're out there, call in.
Now, let's see. In London, this report. The 16 players for a soccer team called Midland-Portland Cement, who were in Zimbabwe for a match in October, were told that a swim in the Zambezi River is a traditional ritual that would cleanse the team of evil spirits. However, only 15 players made it back, as there are crocodiles in the Zambezi River.
Well, that can't be good.
No.
Really? So they go swimming. And the name of the team was
was the Midland Portland Cement.
The Midland Portland Cement. Of course, we have Portland Cement Company in this country. And that guy.
This is the Midlands.
Midlands, yes. Okay, one more.
All right. This is from the Daily Telegraph in London. Hundreds of visitors a day visit the Muslim shrine of Khan Jahan Ali in Bangladesh, where they bathe in a pond to wash away evil spirits and feed chickens to crocodiles to bring good fortune. Normally, the crocodiles are very friendly, said a local police officer. But in August, Mr. Rubel Sheikh was eaten while washing away his evil spirits in a manner not at all friendly.
Hey, it's a jungle out there. Get your hands off that mouse. The Andy Finn Show will be right back. That brings us to the end of another edition of the Andy Finn Show. I want to thank our guest, Steve Farnsworth, for being here. Thanks again, Steve.
Thank you.
We'll see you around the campus. It's the last week of... Oh, we're done with classes. We've got exams now. And thank you, as always, to the lovely Robin. The Finn Man and Robin will be back next week with another edition. Until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.